I'm Christopher Busby. I've been interested for 30 years in the health effects of ionizing radiation, and particularly have focused on the effects of uranium, depleted uranium. I studied depleted uranium in Kosovo, where I visited there with Nippon TV, and I also went to Iraq with Al Jazeera and looked at the effects of depleted uranium. And I've written three scientific papers on the effects of depleted uranium in Iraq, in Fallujah, and then also countless articles and so forth. So I would consider myself an international expert on depleted uranium and what it is and how it affects people in terms of their health and genetic damage and so forth.
Now, so we've recently heard about a spike in gamma detection in Europe. Can you just take us through this a bit, like explain a bit about what is gamma radiation and why you think it might be linked to depleted uranium? Because for most people who even have a basic understanding of radiation, DU is not a gamma emitter. It doesn't emit gamma rays. So it does sound quite counterintuitive as to whether this could even be related to depleted uranium, which the British amazingly have been proud to be supplying to the Ukrainian army.
Well, we'll start with the gamma radiation. There are three types of radiation, basically. There's gamma radiation, which is like light. It's a very sort of powerful form of light in terms of its energy, and it goes right through the body. But on its way through the body, some of it's absorbed and can damage the DNA, and then that leads to cancer and all sorts of other downstream effects. Then there's beta radiation, which are basically electrons, and they have a range in air of about a meter at most, maybe a little bit more or less, depending upon which beta it is, which energy it is. And then there's alpha radiation, which is an alpha particle, which is when the nuclide decays, it gives off a particle which has a very short range, about 3 centimeters, something like that, and it can't penetrate the skin. And so from the point of view of external radiation, it's not really very dangerous. It can't, but if it gets inside you, it's highly ionizing because it's a very short range, and it deposits all its energy in a very short range, about the range of about 4 cells. So in theory, internal alpha emitters, and uranium is one of them, can cause massive damage to the cells that close to the decay. In the case of uranium, the alpha emission from the particles will cause an increased dose rate close to the particle. So the particles below about 3 microns in diameter are effectively a gas. They're aerosols because they're so small. They just float about in the air, and you can inhale them. Then they go into your lung. Then they go into your lymphatic system, and effectively they can get anywhere. And once they lodge somewhere, then of course they keep banging away with their emissions, and so that area becomes much more damaged in terms of its dose. Now, dose is energy per unit mass, and so the way in which this is analysed by governments and by the risk model that we have at the moment, that's basically the International Commission on Radiological Protection, it dishonestly dilutes the energy into the whole organ. This is something that was decided in the 1970s in order to cover the effects of these alpha emitters like plutonium that were being produced in large amounts in the nuclear weapons testing and in the development of nuclear weapons in America and in England, places like Aldermaston. Anyway, in England and various places in America where they make the bombs. So I was on the Depleted Uranium Oversight Board of the Ministry of Defense in around about 2000-2004. Michael Meacher put me on that committee, and I also gave evidence to the Royal Society. But following all of that, they still maintained that you could dilute this energy, alpha energy, into the organ. And so people who were exposed to uranium were supposed to have an extremely small dose. And dose is the problem. It's fairly meaningless when it comes to internal radiation. I was also on a British government committee called the Committee Examining Radiation Risks from Internal Emitters, which sat for about 4 years at the beginning of 2000, 2004. But that was shut down as soon as it started to find something. Misha was sacked as the environment minister by Tony Blair. So they produced a dishonest report. And we produced a minority report, myself and Bramhall, because we were the only people on the committee that held these radiation effects from alpha emitting particles, particularly uranium, were problematical. Of course, there was huge amount of evidence that they were. So if you go to Kosovo, when we did do that, and we looked at the evidence from Kosovo, from the military people there in the Italian military and Portuguese military and so on, and also in Iraq, where you saw these effects in children and cancer in adults, enormous increases in cancer in adults. So what you have here is an epidemiological problem. You have a problem in which on the one level, you have a theory, this is like the risk model, that says that these things are harmless on the basis of what you would call deduction. So they start with dose, and they say, oh, the dose is very small, therefore they can't have an effect. And so when they see the effect, they say there is no effect, and so they just cover it up. And attempts to publish all of this stuff in the peer review literature were blocked and blocked and blocked and blocked. Okay. Let's go forward now to Khmelnytsky, which is a very large explosion that occurred. This is a place sort of halfway, it's to the west of Kiev, it's sort of halfway between Kiev and the border with Poland, slightly south of west. And there was an attack with a missile attack by the Russians on what they said was an arms dump there. And photos appeared on the internet of an explosion, or a few explosions, or two main explosions, which were absolutely massive. When you look at them, and I've seen pictures of similar explosions in Lebanon, and what they show is a black cloud. So there's almost like a nuclear explosion, but it's not a nuclear explosion. There's a big fireball, and it moves upwards, and you get a mushroom cloud with a lot of black soot, if you like, or black particles, and then they drift away. Well, there was it immediately began hearing on the internet, we who follow these things in Ukraine, that there was a big radiation spike associated with this. Okay. And later on, yeah, saw that.
Interrupt you, but do we know when this was? We got it where, but what about
14th when? On the 14th of May. And so what happened is that later on I saw that the Ukrainians were clearing out the debris, and they were putting out the fires with robots. So they had these robot machines. So the question you have to ask is why they were using robot machines to clear out the fire and generally cover things up. There were no firemen people there. They were robot sort of machinery, German machinery it was, like little tracked vehicles blowing water, I suppose, mostly. Anyway, so that's a little piece of evidence. You have to put all these bits of evidence together. But let's just go back now to the alphas, betas, and so on. The fact is that although uranium, depleted uranium as U-238, that's what it is. They take out the nuclear fissile component, which is U-235, and that leaves a U-238 rich material, which they use in the weapons to fire at the tanks. And it's jolly effective, I can tell you, because I've seen the tanks that have been hit by this stuff. When it hits the tank, it burns, and it burns through the tank and produces all this black smoke, which then floats all over the place. Floats over very large distances, incidentally, because it's a gas, as I said earlier. Okay, so the question is, why gamma? Well, the answer is that uranium has two daughters. So you have to know, if you know the physics, that uranium-238 decays to two isotopes, thorium-234 and protoactinium-234M. They go blip, blip, like that. The half-life of the thorium-234 is about 20 days, and the other one's a few minutes. And then it goes to uranium-234. So when you get a piece of DU, what you've got there is you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 isotopes that are all in stochastic equilibrium. So for every blip you get from an alpha emission from U-238, you get a beta emission blip from thorium-234, and another beta emission blip from protoactinium-234M, and then you get the uranium-234, which has quite a long half-life, but even so, it is there. All right, so effectively, when you get a decay from uranium-238, you get blip, 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 like that. It's called stochastic equilibrium. Now, the second two of those are both gamma emitters. They're very weak gamma emitters, but they are gamma emitters. The thorium-234 is the main one that has a gamma emission energy, which comes with the beta that it shoots out. So when it shoots out the beta, it also shoots out a gamma ray. And 6% of all the decays are gamma. So that means if you go anywhere near uranium-238, you will get gamma. And in fact, you can find it like that. So when I was wandering around Iraq, you know, with a Geiger counter, and other people have gone with Geiger counters, and they've looked at tanks that have been hit by these things, and you put the Geiger counter near the tank, and it goes mad. It screams, you know. There's a lot of gamma because there's a lot of uranium. So although uranium is a very weak emitter, has a very long half-life, 4.5 billion years, it is associated with a gamma ray, and the gamma ray can be picked up. So that's the first thing. So the people that say it's only an alpha emitter, and how could it be this and that, and all these excuses that are made about how this spike can be nothing to do with uranium, these are cover-ups. And I noticed the Russians also are covering it up. So what we've got there was a Russian physicist that I've seen talking on YouTube or one of these video channels, I think Telegram. And he's saying that, oh, well, you know, uranium doesn't burn. He says that uranium melts at 1,400 degrees. And even if there was, he said, well, we did hit the thing. And if there was uranium there, it would just all go up in the air and come down again. There would be no uranium in any smoke. Well, that is a lie. And if he's a physicist, he should know that's a lie. So that's another piece of evidence that they're trying to cover this up. Of course, the Russians don't want everyone to freak out and blame them for contaminating Poland. I mean, this is what's happened. Okay, back to what's happened. I was contacted by a few people asking me the same question that you're asking me, and I thought, well, let's go and have a look. So what I managed to do was to go to the EuroDep website, which is the first thing I do, where they have all these detectors all over Europe, which they set up after the Chernobyl accident in order to make sure that nobody was going to get surprised anymore when some power station blew up. And what I found immediately is that the website was down. That is to say, it was there, but it wouldn't give you any information. So you went to one of the points, they had a map there, and you click on one of the places on the map, and it sort of says it says loading and loading and loading, and just ran on and on and on loading. So it wouldn't give you any info. But then someone sent me one graph that had been taken before all this stuff happened. And then I got talking to them, and they'd managed to download a few graphs. So various people sent me graphs of the different sites in Poland. And what they all showed was an enormous increase round about the beginning, over the 15th, right? So then I went to have a look at the historic weather data, and I looked at the pressure map. I'm a yachtsman, so I know how to interpret atmospheric pressure maps. And what they showed was there was a big anticyclone sitting over the north of Ukraine and over Europe. The weather was quite good, sunny weather, you know, not raining and so on. And the weather and the wind was blowing from Khmelnytsky to the northwest. So that in other words, it was blowing, but very slow, very gently. It wasn't any strong wind. It was a very gentle wind, you know, a few knots. And it blew, and it was blowing the remnants of the explosion. It was blowing across into Poland. And of course, basically up through Poland into Germany and then up into the Baltic states and across the whole of Europe, because it then curves around, because you've got a low pressure system to the left of that, so that picks it up and takes it over the top of the low pressure system and back down into Europe through England into France and so forth. So the stuff's coming here, whatever it is. All right. So then we look at Poland, and what we find is that every single detector in Poland goes up suddenly in the middle of the 15th, but you know, at different times. So the times are depend upon how far they are from Khmelnytsky. and the highest effect is a Polish detector on the border. So then the question is, well, what is it? Now, one thing, and you have to be careful, one thing that it could be is radon. I mean, when it rains, when there's a pressure differential, you know, big pressure differential, like a frontal system comes in and there's a lot of rain, you get what's called a radon spike, because there's a natural gas that's emitted from radium, which is radium is in the ground, and the radon is in the ground. And so when there's a pressure differential, it pulls out the radon. But the first thing is that the amount of radon it pulls out is not enough to produce the size of spike that we see here. And the other thing is that this occurs all along the whole border of Poland. So like every single detector goes up in unison in terms of like distance. If you imagine the plume, I haven't done this yet, but I will do this. I can do some plume calculations and show how slowly the thing moves and where it will go to and all the rest of it. I've got a lot of things to do, you know, so I can't do everything. But then, the other thing is that the other suspicious thing is that the Poles themselves started screaming. There's the Marie Curie Institute in Lublin, I think it is, and they published on the net. They published a graph of an increase in gamma radiation in Poland at this detector that they have. But this was a much more interesting graph because it showed it split down the radiation energies into different isotopes. The main isotopes being natural ones. Okay, so it looked at the natural isotopes, and and the reason you would do that is in order to see whether anything was from radon. And what it showed was that there was a peak in bismuth 214, which is a radon daughter. But if you look closely at it, what you see is that actually the peak was really quite small, and it could not possibly have been high enough, because what they do is they show the bismuth 214 energy, and they show the total gamma radiation on the same graph, but with a different scale. So and you have to look very closely, and you have to understand Polish, which I don't, but I got my girlfriend to translate it. And so what you're looking at is a percentage increase in terms of each isotope. So this was a cover-up. The reason that this was produced was that it was to reassure everybody that that the effect was a natural one, that the effect was just due to some radon spike. But if you look closely, you can see it cannot possibly be that, because the total increase was really very small in terms of the proportion of bismuth 214. So listen, I may be wrong, okay? I really may be wrong about this, and it could be that there was a sudden unexplainable increase in radon. But certainly what I can say is that there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what we're seeing here is a really massive public health problem. Yeah. Because these particles are very, very radiogenotoxic, you know, and they cause cancer and they cause birth defects and all the rest of it. And although they're quite far away by the time you get to the west of Poland and everywhere else, I can tell you that they, even at that concentration, are a serious hazard. So the only way that we will know for sure that this is uranium is if somebody traps it all in a filter and then measures it to see if it's uranium, which they can do. They have to do alpha spectroscopy, and that can be done. But in terms of the gamma, what I'm saying is that, first of all, it is a gamma emitter because of the two daughters, thorium-234 and protactinium-234M. So the gamma argument goes out the window. And then the fact that the whole of Poland is covered in this stuff, or rather that the detectors all went up together throughout the whole strip at a given distance from Chemnitsky, suggests that the increase, well, it almost proves that, you know, you can do the statistics on it. It almost proves that whatever it is that's increasing the radiation levels, the gamma radiation levels, is whatever it is that floated over from Chemnitsky. Well, I mean, the wind was in the right direction.
Chris, the vision of this enormous great explosion with this nasty, potentially anyway, nasty smoke, how would something like this compare to Chernobyl? Because, I mean, it must have been an absolutely massive explosion. Obviously, if you hit an arms dump, I mean, that's maybe a month's worth of people shooting in a war going up in smoke in a few seconds.
Oh, you're talking about thousands of tons of uranium, mate. I mean, you know, so it's not a small deal. And that's why, of course, they're all covering up like mad. That's the point. Everybody's freaking out. That's why they shut down the Germans the German server operates the European detector circuit system. Okay, that's what they do. And it's actually the stuff put together in Italy, but the actual circuit is put on the web in Germany somewhere. But then immediately they shut it down. Okay, so there's another piece of evidence. Now it's come back up, but it's come back up in a way that when you look at all the detectors, which you can do, they've changed the way in which they display it. So you can't see any peak. They've averaged it over a few days or whatever it is. So all you get is like a flat line.
What's happened? Because quite clearly, you know, you as a one-time government advisor on all this, you know, we've got now what used to be a kind of rigorous science where all of the different views are being put forward in the public interest. And, you know, for example, you producing the minority report, you were saying, and now it almost seems like there's some kind of stage management, pantomime style, you know, scientism, you know, where you've just got a few scientists who will say what they, the industry and the government want them to say and won't step outside. So what's happened over that period?
Well, what's happened is what happened after the Iraq war, basically. They came to realize that the way in which people understood reality, if you like to call it that, was determined by what they saw in the media. So the media, after the Iraq war, and after the death of David Kelly and the sacking of the BBC guy, Greg, whatever his name is, increasingly since then, all of the media have been curtailed and controlled, and anybody who steps out of line gets dismissed or put off to one side. I mean, you know this. We can all see this. You know that the nonsense that they talk, for instance, in the Telegraph about the war in Ukraine and how Zelensky's winning the war and all our Challenger tanks and our depleted uranium is going to finish off Putin, and you know all this total absolute nonsense. Anybody who knows what's going on knows that the Russians are winning. The Russian economy is okay. The American economy is going down the toilet. The whole world is changing. But what the people hear in the media here is just a kind of theater. I mean, that is the problem. And things are just going to get worse and worse and worse until all of the economic system and the worst crashes. Well, but people like me, scientists like me, are excluded. They're pushed out sideways.
Yeah, it's the wrong story. That's what they used to call it in the news. Remember, I was in Marylebone High Street. Hey, Tony, that's the wrong story.
It happens in the science literature as well. Although I've been getting more, I'm being more and more successful in the science literature. I'm getting stuff in all over the place. And as far as they're concerned, I'm public enemy number one. Because what I'm doing is I'm showing that their radiation risk model is a dishonest load of nonsense, and it's resulted in the cancer epidemic. Everybody's had somebody who died of cancer. That the fallout from the nuclear weapons testing in the 60s got into people's genetic makeup and produced cancer and reduced the fertility rate. And goodness me, you know, it's like a lot of stuff. And at the same time, I'm just being I'm being squeezed money. You know, I mean, you say we published the minority report, but in those days we got some money from the foundations like the Joseph Grantree Charitable Trust and various and Goldsmith supported us and so forth. So we could do all that now. But now I'm more or less isolated in all of this. Most of my colleagues on the European Committee, they're all old guys. And they're all dead. Yablokov is dead, and Rosalie Bertel is dead, and Alice Stewart is dead, and young scientists now are not interested in all this. And why would they be? Because there's no money in it, you know. And they go to a university and start talking about the health effects of radiation, they get booted out almost immediately. So all you get is a load of tame scientists who sort of suck the tit of the government in order to survive and pay their mortgages and so on. And people like me have to sort of live in cardboard boxes and do all this stuff on the basis of nothing at all. And, you know, it's very, very difficult to do that. I couldn't publish the minority report now. I'm just on an old age pension. And the person in America who was supporting me dropped dead under suspicious circumstances. And all the court cases that I was helping with in America that brought in a bit of money that funded all my work, they've just been bought out by the you know, the nuclear industry. It's really is quite critical, you know.
I mean, the other thing is the evidence here is that you may well be right, because why would anyone bother with all this kind of thing if you were just talking nonsense?
Well, yes, exactly. You're shaking the right tree. That's what everybody used to, Americans used to say. Well, you know, you're shaking the right tree.
Just talking about the Ukraine war, we had Ben Wallace last week literally almost cheering the idea that he's now absolutely open about thinking it's a delightful idea that all this depleted uranium ammunition should be sent to Ukraine. And yet we do know about the congenital birth defects. I mean, basically hideous, unborn, and when they are born, stillborn children, kind of strange creatures, almost looking like this from something from outer space, being born to mothers into the indefinite future in the areas where this DU has been used. So it's not really going to be good for Ukraine.
Well, I have to say that this latest thing is a fantastic irony, that the British send all this depleted uranium to Ukraine. They blow it all up and it goes to Poland. How about that? And the Poles are and Poland and Lithuania and the Baltic states and so on. Just you know, they're the kind of epicenter of attacks. It's sort of like mad attacks on Russia, and they're now at the receiving end of the stuff that Ben Wallace, or not whoever, you know, the Rishi Sunak sent to Ukraine. So he sent it to Ukraine. Putin blows it all up and it flows across to Poland. I mean, really, it's quite ironic and entertaining, although it would, you know, except that it isn't.
Well, you've got a very dark sense of humour. What about, look, just on a sort of historical angle, I always found it a bit peculiar that the Allies developed the atomic bomb first. If you look at the people who, I mean, they split the atom just before the Second World War. I think it was 1938 in Berlin. The real experts in all of this were the people who actually designed the first atomic weapon, we're told, were Frisch and Piles, one of whom was Hungarian, the other of whom was Austrian. I mean, it did really look, if you looked at, and also I think it's in his book Most Secret War, the government's chief scientific advisor was saying that Winston Churchill was constantly bricking it, basically, that a V2 was going to land on London with a nuke in it. And if you look at the race that was going on in World War II, that was possible, because the atomic bomb could have completely changed the situation. Say an atomic weapon, and the Germans did have these long-range aircraft based in Norway that could have reached New York and bombed New York and then come back to Norway. Obviously, the V2s were hitting London. So what about this race in World War II? What do you make of that? Because, I mean, I've spoken
well,
to...
I've read a lot about that.
He was telling me that a lot of the technology that the Americans got at the end of the war, they got from the Germans. So what do you make of that race in World War II to create the first bomb?
It was just bad luck, I think. The fact is that the Germans at that time just didn't have the technology and the money and the petrol and diesel and all the stuff that they needed to do. The first thing you've got to do, even if you know theoretically it's possible, is you've got to get pure or pretty highly enriched uranium. You've got to get the U-235 out of the mix. So first of all, you have to have a huge amount of the uranium ore, of high-quality uranium ore. And and the Germans didn't have a huge amount of high-quality uranium ore. The Americans got it from Belgium. Where they had these mines where you had enormously high concentration uranium. And then the Americans developed this Manhattan Project. And the amount of energy and personnel and money that went into that was astronomical. And they could just sit and do that. I mean, nobody was bombing them. So in order for the Germans to do that, they had to find somewhere to do it. And wherever they started to do this research, the British just bombed them. They wanted heavy water for reactors, so the British sent a load of people over to Norway and blew up the Norsk hydroelectric plant so they couldn't get it. So it wasn't that they didn't know that that was a possibility, that Churchill didn't know that that was a possibility. He'd been advised about the possibility, and as I understand, he was a bit nervous about it, but not terribly nervous. But the Americans took it very seriously under Vannevar Bush, incidentally, the first of the Bushes. He was behind all of that stuff, and they diverted enormous amounts of money into the Manhattan Project, and the British worked with them over there. So a lot of British scientists went over there. And the British scientific advisor to Churchill was a bit skeptical about the possibility of doing this, you know. So he was badly advised by the guy that he had a scientific advisor, was a friend of his. I can't remember his name now. So it was just a lot of circumstances that happened to be the case. But the main problem, as I see it, was that the Germans didn't have the capacity. They didn't have the kind of either the capacity in terms of the huge amounts of uranium ore necessary to do all this stuff, or the capacity in terms of building all the structures and so on. They didn't have the money. They were just on the back foot, and they were being bombed and all the rest of it, you know. And so they thought that the best way to win the war was to win the war quickly, and the atomic bomb was not going to be something that would happen at the time that it did happen. I think that's basically the answer, is that they just didn't have the resources.
We're over in Lisbon at the Bilderberg meeting this week. I wonder what you make of that. They're talking a lot about technology, how technology is going to save us somehow. I mean, we've got one of the main themes here. Obviously, they're talking about Ukraine. They usually put it at the bottom of their official agenda, although, of course, it's very important to NATO, because this really is a sort of NATO political lobby here. But they're talking a lot about AI, and they are saying effectively that there are going to be thousands, actually Goldman Sachs, who feature very heavily here, along with the all the big banks, basically are saying something like 300 million jobs are going to be lost due to AI. But so what do you make of this kind of so-called leap forward in technology? It does seem like it's another kind of poison chalice.
It's a sort of leap sideways, actually. I mean, the idea that's being sold is that AI is going to produce people sort of like a super intelligence. But of course, it's not going to produce a super intelligence, but it is going to produce a super intelligent system for controlling people. That's what it's for. It's a bit like the printing press, you know. So what you had before was people believed in God and so forth, and then you printed the Bible, and then they thought they had to think differently. And then people were writing things that they could read, and they could then think differently. And the point with AI is that it has the ability, because it is so monstrously powerful in terms of thinking velocity, thinking speed, is that it can examine data and come to some conclusion about the data, which an ordinary human being would just not be able to do, you know, in the time available. So it can respond very quickly to changes in ideas and so forth, and it can then pump this stuff back into the human race to stupidify people. And of course, it will do that. And so the point is that the way in which we think now is we think through the internet. We look at videos, and we look at this, and we look at that. AI can make a video. AI can make a video in which Joe Biden comes out and says something extremely intelligent, and you think, oh my goodness me, what an intelligent man! Oh, we must vote for him. That kind of thing. That's where AI is going to be dangerous. It's going to be extremely dangerous. And people like Musk and other people who develop the AI and so on are all screaming and yelling and freaking out about it all, and they're quite right to do that. But the idea of AI somehow getting us to a Terminator society where the machines take over, I think that's unlikely myself. But it is quite a frightening. And of course, the work, you know, quite so. All people will not people who work won't be needed anymore. They don't have to make decisions because AI will make decisions. But those decisions will make a difference to the way in which the world moves. But of course, the problem is that the world is going down the toilet anyway, you know, because of the lack of resources and because of all the people fighting each other and so on.
Lots of crises, but you might even say compare this to the Industrial Revolution. I mean, they do talk about it as the fourth Industrial Revolution. This is the way it's spun. But the problem, of course, back in those days was that people were sort of robbed of the resources they needed to just basically feed their families through the enclosures and mass evictions, so that people had to go and work in a factory. And, of course, at the end of the day, it's not the technology that's important, but who owns it?
Well, of course, what is the most sensible solution to the planet, and that is to kill everybody. Okay, well, there are too many people, there's too few resources, And the rich people are afraid of the masses. That's always been the case, increasingly been the case over the last 100 years, you know. So if you want to draw an arrow, the arrow is to a future in which what they want to do is to reduce the population of the earth so that its carrying capacity is maintained. And how will they do that? Well, they'll have some very clever, tricky way of doing it, because they've got AI. AI will say, do this, do that, do the other. I mean, you could almost see the Ukrainian war in those terms, right? The Ukrainian war, to my mind, is a way in which you're going to wipe out the population of Ukraine. I mean, that's why they want Zelensky to continue to fight and not to sue for peace and to argue, you know, for partition and go back to some place where people live happily, you know. All right, they're in the Donbass or in the Ukraine, but basically they don't care. They want to speak their language and they want to do work and they want to live and they want their children to be happy and so forth, right? But the British don't want that, or the powerful people don't want that, if you like, you know, the people running the world, the Bilderbergers probably, they don't want that, because what they want is for everybody into Ukraine to die and for the amount of money to be given to Ukraine so that everybody, so that the government and everything there is in debt to the West. And then, of course, they own it. Just like the Baltic states. So they walk in there, and then of course the Israelis, who are now having a lot of problems in the Middle East, everything's getting hotter and hotter, and the Palestinians are going to sort of eventually get them in some way. So what do they want? They want Lebensraum. They want somewhere to go and live. So where better to go than to Odessa? You know, I mean, it's lovely there. So Ukraine is a beautiful, beautiful country. And of course all the men will be dead, so there'll be all these beautiful women there. I mean, if you want to be cynical about it all, that might well be the operation, the intended operation for Ukraine. Because you have to ask, why do they want the Ukrainian soldiers and the Ukrainian populations to either be bombed out or continually fight a bigger army, which is obviously going to destroy them and is destroying them, you know, all the time that we speak. Every time I look, there's some new movement. And of course, you know, Putin's laughing. He just sits on his hands. He watches the dollar collapse. He's got all the resources. He can tie in with China, and he doesn't have to do anything at all. So he kills all the Azov Brigade and all the Ukrainian army and so forth. That's great for the West. They want these people dead so they can then walk in and take over the country on some sort of debt-related, you know, through the banks. It's very easy to see where all this goes. Well, just imagine how it will work under AI. I mean, AI, for that kind of thing, AI is perfect. You know, it can work out what to say and who to vote for and all the rest of it. And the idiots will all vote for them, you know.
Well, because maybe people will just, you know, the carrying capacity of the planet can all sort of start relaxing as people kind of just completely ditch technology and start small holdings, you know, some basic.
Oh, well, yeah, let's hope that happens. But I mean, I've been watching that ever since I was in the Green Party, and it doesn't happen. What happens is that the laws are changed, and you can't do this and you can't do that, and planning permission the other, and they slowly squeeze you into the ground.
Mm. Well, that's what happens. Try, Chris, but you know, in a way, I do see a future where many of these people, because they're trying to take on so many people, I mean, they're trying to take on the Chinese, the Russians, and their own domestic populations all at the same time, and they may actually be on a hiding to nothing. Anyway, look, Chris Busby, where do people follow your research, your work, etc.?
Well, I have to say I haven't been doing very much in terms of disseminating it, but if you go to Green Audit, www.greenaudit.org, you will find a lot of stuff, but not the very latest stuff. The very latest stuff, you just have to go to Google. I'm on Google now. So if I find something,
I mean, the glass you're talking about to do with this explosion in the west of Ukraine.
I haven't published anything about that.
Okay.
I'm talking to some people about it, and they're going to, well, they say they're going to publish something about it. I've had a lot of other things to do lately, so I put some of this stuff on my Facebook page, and people who ask me about it, I tell them about it, and so on. I'm going to do something. I'm going to make a video about all of this, but I don't really need to because of people like you, Tony. You know, I mean, I was on RT. Russia Today got onto me, and they asked me about all of this stuff. So, but of course, you can't see RT unless you've got some kind of bypass system. You know,
you're working on VK.com, and then there are various other ways to do it. Anyway, look, Chris Busby, thanks very much. It sounds to me like Facebook is a good first touch point to get some information about this. Thanks.
I usually, if I do something new, I stick it out on my Facebook thing.
Thank you very much for joining us again.
Cheers.